From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, a close look at the fighting in Yemen. The war on Yemen continues to rage, and Saudi Arabia continues to cause civilian casualties in that impoverished country. We begin with this report from Press TV's Bardia Honardar.
Iran calls for effective international action to send the much-needed humanitarian aid to Yemen in order to prevent a human catastrophe in the war-torn country. Deputy Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has said that miscalculations by certain countries violate international norms and humanitarian principles and worsen the ongoing crisis in Yemen. He added that Yemeni civilians have been the main victims of the current situation. He made the remarks in a meeting with Robert Mardini, the regional director for the Near and Middle East at the International Committee of the Red Cross. Mardini, in return, thanked Iran for its humanitarian aid to Yemen, Iraq, and Syria. Joining us now in our studios here in Tehran is Fuad Izzetti, professor of University of Tehran. Professor Izzetti, welcome to the program. Give us your thoughts on the recent comments made by Deputy Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian, and on the side of that, a high-ranking official from the International Committee of the Red Cross, Robert Mardini, has thanked Iran for its humanitarian aid to Yemen. How would you assess Iran's role in giving in and sending an aid to Yemenis in need?
Well, as you know, yesterday the UN Commissioner on Human Rights announced that over 21 million people in Yemen are in need of urgent humanitarian needs. They have needs. They have people starving in Yemen, basically. What Iran has been saying from the very beginning is that the situation in Yemen does not have a military answer. We need to reach a political settlement in Yemen and stop the fighting, stop the suffering of ordinary people. As you know, thousands of people have been killed and injured by Saudi aggression. We have hospitals that are out of medicine. We have children that are dying because of the basic needs are not met. So I think what needs to happen is not only for Iran, but other countries need to also realize the very desperate situation that civilians in Yemen have. You know, the only port city that was bringing aid from the outside was bombed by the Saudis a couple of weeks ago, and a very bad situation became worse. So other countries beside Iran also need to realize that you're basically facing a genocide in Yemen. Ordinary citizens are being killed, and their crime is rejecting a president that actually had resigned, and a president that is supported by a foreign power, by the Saudis. People of Yemen have the right to decide what political system they want to have, whom they want to govern them. What we have in Yemen is a situation where the Saudis are bombing every day. The international media, unfortunately, is not really covering the dire situation in Yemen properly. The petrodollars that Saudis have is basically buying a lot of silence in the international scene, and people are dying every day, and it's Iran that is opposing this situation, is objecting to this situation. And then they say that Iran is interfering in Yemeni affairs. Every country at this moment needs to interfere in the dire situation that we have in Yemen. And hundreds of thousands are going to be seriously hurt if nothing is done.
Professor Izzetti, Deputy Foreign Minister Amir Abdullahian spoke of miscalculations, quote-unquote, by certain countries that violate international norms and are worsening the ongoing crisis in Yemen. Those miscalculations not only have humanitarian repercussions, but in many views, security repercussions as well. Some analysts believe that the actions of the Saudis is not only endangering security in the region, but it would also have negative repercussions for themselves, for the Saudis as well. Do you see it in that light too?
You know, it's always the case. A country can start a war, but finishing the war that countries start is not always their choice. So they have, the Saudis have decided to engage in war crimes. They have decided to kill civilians in Yemen on a daily basis. There are talks of ground invasion. We have a situation where the Saudi king thinks that Yemen is part of Saudi Arabia. They want to be a dictator in Yemen the same way they are dictators in Saudi Arabia. And the response that the people of Yemen are going to have to the Saudis is going to be very severe. For many decades to come, Yemeni people are not going to forget how Saudis have destroyed their country. This is not really going to be good for the Saudi foreign policy or the relations with Yemen. And this is, I think, what the Iranian official was talking about. This is a major miscalculation. Saudis and Yemenis are going to be neighbors forever. And when you attack your neighbor in this manner, when you prevent the basic humanitarian aids to reach these people, when you kill women and children on a daily basis, then these things are not going to be forgotten. And I think Saudis will pay a very high price in the future and as we speak.
Indeed. Professor Fouad Izzati joining us in our studios here in Tehran. Thank you for your comments, Professor. Yemen's Ansarullah fighters and their allied army units have taken full control of Rabwa city in Saudi Arabia's southern Asir region. They've launched a massive attack against the city, forcing Saudi troops to leave the area. Rabwa is strategically important because it links several cities in southern Saudi Arabia. Meanwhile, Ansarullah fighters backed by army units have inflicted heavy losses on Saudi troops in Yemen's central province of Ma'arib. Over a dozen Saudi armored vehicles were destroyed in the fighting. The Saudi Interior Ministry says a border guard has been killed in an exchange of fire with Yemeni forces in Jizan. The United Arab Emirates has also confirmed the death of one of its soldiers in the battlefield. Activist and political commentator Hossein Al-Bukhaiti joins us now from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. Mr. Al-Bukhaiti, talk to us about the events that are taking place on the ground in Yemen, most notably the Ansarullah fighters and their retaliatory actions against the Saudi invasion and occupation of Yemen.
We've seen in the last days like two kind of retaliation action headed by Ansarullah and the Yemeni army. First one is inside the Saudi border. As in the last days, Ansarullah, the Houthis and the Yemeni army has controlled over six Saudi army position, and they have seized the city of Al-Rabu'a in south of Asir. Until this moment, they are advancing to cut some of the major supplies of the Saudi army to border with the Hajjah, which is north of Yemen. And the second type of retaliation is the constant attack on Saudi forces, United Arab Emirates forces, and their loyalists in the province of Ma'arib. Yesterday, the Yemeni army and Ansarullah the Houthi has launched dozens of Uragan rockets, and they targeted the third army divisions in that area. That hit HQ of the Saudi and United Arab Emirates in Ma'arib, and there are reports of many casualties, and the United Arab Emirates has announced the loss of an officer in that area, but I'm sure that the numbers could rise more than that anytime soon.
And what about the international community's response and role in the war on Yemen? Surely they could play a more tangible role in stopping the bloodshed caused by the Saudi attacks.
I think the international community, like the UN and the UN Security Council, they are involved directly in this attack against Yemen. We know that the Saudi has invaded Aden during a ceasefire that was negotiated by the UN, and the UN hasn't released any statement condemning that, and as well that there is a blockade on Yemen, and all ships must go through Djibouti, and before the invasion of Aden, the United Arab Emirates and Qatar were sending ships into Aden without sending them to Djibouti to be searched by the UN, and there are many reports that those ships were used to bring weapons into Yemen under the nose of the United Nations. We have seen what's happening in Palestine now. The Arab world is watching Palestine and watching the Israeli aggression, while they have made a coalition to attack their Arab brother and their neighboring country in Yemen.
Thank you very much, activist and political commentator Hossein Abdelkhaiti, joining us from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a.
CCTV's Anan Naidu spoke with three experts on the program, The Heat.
Joining me now here in our Washington studio is Abdul Latif Al-Mulhim. He is a daily columnist for the Saudi newspaper Al-Yawm, and joining us from London is Catherine Shakdam. She is a political analyst and commentator on Middle East issues. Her work has appeared in major publications. Also with us, Adnan Tabatabai. He is a political analyst on Iranian affairs and joins us from Dusseldorf in Germany. Welcome to all of you to the show. Adnan, let me start with you. You know, as we heard from our previous guest, there is a great deal of suspicion over Iranian intentions in the Middle East. There's a great deal of suspicion over the nuclear deal that Iran has signed with world powers. What do you make of these beliefs that Iran is seeking regional domination?
I think there is no doubt that Iran has always been perceiving itself as a regional power, has also been perceived by others as a regional power. After the revolution of 79, Iran has been more and more trying to be, or let's say others try to isolate Iran, not let Iran be in that role as a regional power, and therefore some of its regional policies may have been appearing hostile to others, since Iran wanted to maintain its position in the region. And I think this agreement has changed a bit the context in that regard, that Iran is more and more viewed as a regional power, and therefore I believe Iran's actions in the region will also shift towards more constructive policies, more of a conciliatory approach.
Catherine, we know that Saudi Arabia is taking on Houthi rebels in Yemen, neighboring Yemen. What is your assessment of Saudi Arabia's role in Yemen? Is it a good thing or a bad thing for the region?
I think it's a very bad thing for the region, and only because they're promoting instability and they're enabling radical groups such as Al-Qaeda and ISIS to actually take hold onto the country, which we know is already a failed state, on the brink of a humanitarian catastrophe and economically broken. And to top it all, Saudi Arabia has made sure that all the military apparatus of Yemen has been laid to waste, and therefore the military will be incapable and unable to combat Al-Qaeda or ISIS, for that matter, should the group decide to take actions against the people, which they already are.
Abdul Latif, a former advisor to the Saudi royal court, Nawaf Obaid, he recently was quoted as saying that this is a Saudi moment for the region. Do you agree? Is Saudi Arabia becoming more assertive in the Middle East?
Well, first of all, Saudi Arabia did possess a very, very strategic a top position in the Middle East for a long time. People are relating to Yemen as an intervention, but we never wanted this intervention. But the situation in Yemen is becoming so chaotic that we had no chance but to interfere. So if people want to look at Saudi Arabia from this perspective as a dominating power or something, these are our personal opinions. We have seen Western countries like the United States or the United Kingdom interfering in countries that are thousands of miles away because they are a threat. So in Saudi Arabia, it's more of that. Yemen is a bordering country to Saudi Arabia, and it has been very, very unstable for a long time, and the chaotic thing in Yemen is a big threat to Saudi Arabia. We have to be very frank.
Catherine, go ahead.
No, I just wanted to say that even though I can appreciate that some people understand Saudi's intervention in Yemen is legitimate, I would argue, however, that from an international law point of view, it is not only illegitimate, it's immoral and illegal. So I don't see how anyone could justify, you know, attacking a foreign country when that country didn't do anything to attack the attacking country in the first place. This is not, you know, this is not a case of self-defense. This is an invasion, and this is actually, you know, a form of colonialism. You have one superpower trying to, you know, pounding at the poorest nation in the peninsula, and they're causing, you know, the death of hundreds and thousands of civilians. And we know now from Human Rights Watch and countless other rights organizations that they are systematically targeting civilian population. And I would actually argue that, you know, some sectarian profiling goes into it.
No, I disagree. First of all, Saudi Arabia have done a tremendous job before the current escalation of the conflict. We tried to do it peacefully with the other Gulf states, but we found no other solution but to use this kind of force, because it happened before, like a couple of years ago, when the Houthis attacked the southern borders of Saudi Arabia, and we had no chance but to re-attack. Saudi Arabia share hundreds of miles of borders with Yemen. Yemen has a population of 30 million people, and the infrastructure in Yemen is one of the worst in the whole world. So this recent clash between Saudi Arabia and Yemen happened only after it was found that Yemen is becoming a threat, after the Houthis overtook overtook Yemen, and they are becoming a threat to the southern border.
Okay, let me bring in Adnan here. Adnan, the conventional narrative that we hear is that these are two regional powers fighting for domination in the Middle East, and what we are seeing is basically a proxy war between these two forces. Is that the case?
Well, I think it's a bit difficult to put it this way, because obviously, as our colleague in your studio is saying, Yemen is a bordering country, 1,700 kilometers to Saudi Arabia. So for Saudi Arabia, there's much more at stake in Yemen than is for Iran. Therefore, there is much more to gain and to win and to control for Saudi Arabia than has ever been for Iran. Therefore, the stakes for Saudi Arabia in Yemen are much, much higher, and it would be exaggerated to believe that Iran has so much interest in Yemen that it is accepting to get involved in a conflict which is far away, while being struggling with threats to its security, to Iran's security in neighboring countries, Iraq and Afghanistan, and also to its interests in Syria. Therefore, I think this narrative that you are referring to was pushed through by not only the Saudi kingdom, but also other countries in the Gulf who kept this, who wanted to push this narrative into the media to say this is a battle between Iran and Saudi Arabia, while it is actually a battle in which Saudi Arabia is trying to keep or to thwart a security threat from coming in from Yemen. And I would tend to agree to our colleague in London who says that how much of a threat is that really to Saudi Arabia? But then again, I would say let's appreciate and let the Saudis themselves say what is a threat to them and what is not, but keep things on your own personal country focus and do not bring external actors as excuses for some of the actions that are adopted in Yemen.
Well, there are many proofs that Iran was involved in Yemen, but put it this way, why would Saudi Arabia want to destroy Yemen? We don't. As a matter of fact, believe it or not, every single Saudi... every single Saudi in Saudi Arabia, either official or regular citizen, do sympathize with Yemen, and we want a very, very stable Yemen. Why should Saudi Arabia? I mean, we spent billions of dollars to help Yemen get up on its feet for the past many decades. We built schools, we built infrastructure. There are, even during the war in Saudi Arabia, we had corrected the status of hundreds of thousands of Yemenis. We didn't kick them out of the kingdom. We actually corrected their status, and they're working in Saudi Arabia alongside the Saudis. Every Saudi citizen is dealing with Yemenis on a daily basis.
Okay, so let me ask Catherine to respond to that. Why would the Saudis... I'll come to you in a moment, Adnan. Catherine, why would the Saudis want to destroy Yemen?
Well, one of the main immediate threat that Yemen posed to Saudi Arabia was that Yemen was on the verge of becoming a real democratic state. And of course, for the theocracy, which is Saudi Arabia, this is not something they're willing to tolerate. Yemen would be the only country in the peninsula surrounded by other kingdoms, you know, which kingdoms are actually satellites of Saudi Arabia, you know, to exist next to the most violent theocracy of the world. And of course, that doesn't sit very well with Riyadh. And the second thing that you need to understand as well is not just to look at Yemen, but look at the region. And systematically, either America or the Saudi have gone after military superpower in the region. You had first Iraq, and then Syria, and then now Yemen. And if Yemen doesn't pose a threat militarily to Saudi Arabia, that it will be very easily, you know, very easy to buy its politician, which they have done for decades, by the way, and to make sure that, you know, access to all resources are guaranteed by Riyadh and secured by Riyadh. And, you know, as far as the Saudi borders goes with Yemen, I'd like to say that three of the southern provinces of Saudi Arabia are actually Yemeni land, which were stolen, you know, back in 2000. They are actually sold to the former president of Yemen. So I think that a lot of people there would argue that it's still Yemeni land.
Okay, I'll come to you in a moment, Abdul Latif. Okay. Let's go to Adnan. Adnan, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, I mean, I would actually tend to believe that there is no interest for Saudi Arabia to destroy Yemen or to kill Yemenis. But as a matter of fact, the actions at the moment are leading to the worsening of a situation of a country which was already a failed state. And throughout the past years and maybe even decades, Saudi Arabia has constantly been weakening the central government of Yemen, supporting tribes whom they thought are loyal to them, and never ever strengthening a proper central government. And I think the most destabilizing thing in the Middle East and in the Gulf area is the collapse of central governments and non-state actors and militias becoming stronger and stronger. Saudi Arabia is not the only country, obviously, who is supporting non-state actors in the region, but it is a country whom we tend to not speak that much about when it comes to asking ourselves why are groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS so strong. Because there has been a lot of support from the Saudi kingdom for some non-state actors, and by this short-term thinking, of course there is the danger of destroying a country like Yemen, while at the same time I believe it is not in the interest of Saudi Arabia to destabilize the region or to destroy Yemen. But right now the current policies seem to be very, very destructive for the region, and therefore one can ask, is that the goal? Which I, however, still think is not the goal, which makes you wonder why this war.
Abdul Latif, what do you make of that? I mean, is it in the interest of Saudi Arabia to destabilize
Yemen? Yeah, I have to make two points. Right. First of all, to Adnan, we tried to help the central government in Yemen. Again, not today, but for decades. And but the problem with Yemen is totally divided by tribal. As far as Catherine's comment about the three provinces belonging to Yemen, we stole them. This is a comment that I wouldn't even comment on. I mean, I wouldn't even discuss it. Mm-hmm. Just it's absurd to be very, very frank. What Saudi Arabia had done for Yemen is something that had never been done for any other country from our side. Apparently, Yemen is a very, very fractured country. And each region of Yemen is not knowing what the other region is doing. So it's we tried our best to avoid this war. We tried our best to avoid civilian casualties. But it's the problem in Yemen can only be solved by the Yemenis. But as far as Catherine's talk about Yemen is a threat to us because it was supposed to be becoming a democratic country, I mean, let's be frank. Yemen is ruled by tribal system. Mm-hmm. And the threat to Yemen that Saudi Arabia really no. tried to take out, they have big threat from lack of water. Right. Yemen doesn't have any kind of water. The infrastructure is totally destroyed. It's only the Yemenis who can do it. Okay. No other country outside.
Catherine, are we going to see lots more conflict and instability in the region? I mean, what is it going to take to reach some kind of long-term stability there?
I think that the main thing would be for, you know, foreign powers to actually, you know, back off a little bit and let nation really assist nation rather than tell them what to do and have people, you know, to decide for themselves. I think that political self-determination is absolutely key, and we need to assist country and again not try to impose, you know, foreign policies onto them because, you know, it is more, you know, it suits, you know, certain capitals' agenda. That is the main thing. And, you know, the second thing is we need to stop using, you know, binary narrative and trying to divide people along along sectarian line or regional line or tribal line and try to really build nationalism and have people have a sense of identity. Because when people, you know, understand that they share a common history and common tradition, they are more likely to work together towards the same goal, because at the end of the day, everyone wants the same thing, which is, you know, have a life of dignity and be able to raise their children in peace without the fear of war. You know, it is, you know, those are universal values. And until, you know, the international community comes together and really honor, you know, international law and decide to act upon it, you know, things will get better. And if not, things will continue to descend into madness. And, you know, Syria and Iraq and Yemen will be repeated all over.
It is said that the Americans have no permanent friends, only permanent interests. Actually, the U.S. seems to have no friends at all, but only tools to be used and disposed of, especially in Africa. Hissein Habre helped the CIA inflict a serious defeat on Colonel Muammar Gaddafi of Libya. A few years later, he was replaced by another Chadian warlord and now sits before an extraordinary African Chambers court to answer for his and the U.S.'s crimes, but he sits alone, as Black Agenda Report's Glenn Ford reports.
When the trial of former Chadian President Hissein Habre began this week in Dakar, Senegal, the judges and the guards treated the defendant like Bobby Seale at the Chicago 7 trial back in 1969. The 72-year-old Habre was carried into the courtroom by four guards and forced to sit still in his seat as he shouted mercenaries and scofflaws at the judges. It was much the same scene as back in July, when the extraordinary African Chambers Court first attempted to try Habre for alleged crimes against humanity, torture, and war crimes. The former strongman yelled, "Down with imperialism," and denounced Senegalese politicians as African traitors and valets of America. Which is quite interesting, because Hissein Habre used to be a client of America and a tool of U.S. imperialism himself between the years 1982 and 1990, when he's alleged to have committed all those crimes. Habre was a willing asset of both the United States and the French former colonial masters of Chad, who made good use of him in their proxy war against Colonel Muammar Gaddafi's government in the neighboring country of Libya. With the CIA's help, Habre managed to defeat Gaddafi's forces in the 1986 so-called Toyota War and to kill 40,000 of his own countrymen in his vast political prison system, where another 200,000 were held and tortured. Habre served the Americans so well, Gaddafi gave up trying to influence events in Chad, leaving it to the Americans and Europeans. Soon, Hissein Habre was no longer needed, and in 1990 was overthrown by Idriss Deby, a warlord from an ethnic group that had suffered greatly under Habre. But nothing has changed in Chad except the name and the tribe of the puppet. The U.S. and France remain the real powers in charge. Needless to say, the United States and France are not sitting in the dock with Hissein Habre, who faces the consequences of their mutual crimes alone. Habre might have escaped judgment entirely had pressures for his arrest not caught up with him. The out-of-work warlord has spent most of the last 25 years in quiet exile in Senegal. The Belgians had claimed universal jurisdiction to prosecute him. But what kind of justice would that have been, given that the King of Belgium killed as many as 12 million Congolese and countless other Africans during the colonial period? the Senegalese refused to hand Habré over to the Belgians. Then, in 2010, the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, asked the African Union to create a special tribunal to try Habré. In 2013, Habré was arrested. The extraordinary African Chambers Court is thought by some to be a test of whether Africa can dispense justice to its own current and former politicians. But the question is posed incorrectly. Africa is full of presidents that have killed and imprisoned their own people, most of them while working as agents and mercenaries for U.S. imperialism, the main source of the crime wave. Until the American, British, and French are made to sit in the dock with the Hissène Habrés of the continent, there can be no justice. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.